post-World War divisions. But before this, Syria is one large region. So from a historical and ancient point of view, the Arab world can be divided into three parts, specifically the Arab world. We're not talking about Europe and Africa now, just the Arab world. It can be divided into the Iraq and its peripheral regions, and then there's Sham, and we talked about what Sham and Syria, what that represents, and then there's a separate sort of cut-off peninsula, and that is Al-Jazeera, which nowadays we call it Gulf. But when we use Gulf nowadays, we're referring to some Gulf states, Saudi Arabia and some of these regions. But the Gulf of the old times, the Jazeera of the old times, is a much wider geographical region, almost a triangle, which meets seas on three sides. Not four sides, but on three sides. And it includes Yemen. Nonetheless, Yemen is kind of cut off. It's there, but it's not too connected. It's a little bit to the side, and that becomes important historically, as we will see also. So now, for a great period in history, Yemen controlled, and the rule of Saba controlled the trade between Europe and the rest of the world, and between Asia and the rest of the world. This was the avenue by which they would have to go. Their ports were of strategic importance. So this was what gave them their economic strength and also their political importance. Because when you're important strategically, economically, right, then your political power also rises. So this was one of the main means by which they had their importance. Now the Great Flood occurs once again around the year 450 and 451, and what happens to them as a civilization? It's collapsed. That economy is gone. And the ports are destroyed. Now pretty much everything they had going for themselves is finished. So that route that used to be for trade is no longer. Now there are other means by which route this travel needs to take place. Now this is a little bit of background on the Yemen side. How is this connected to Arabia? A lot of Arabs, or Yemenis or Arabs also, they left that region and they started traveling to other parts of the Arab world. And they started settling as tribes in different places. Now Yemenis have been traveling for a long time. Some narrations even say that the first tribe that came with Ismail alayhi salam way before this, when they saw the water, right? That was also a Yemeni tribe originally. So they've been traveling and leaving Yemen for other travels within the Arab world for a long time already. But this was a major exodus because of the economic downfall in that region. By the way, Aus and Khazraj also historically happened to be tribes that left Yemen for economic reasons and settled in Medina. So they're also, their history is traced back to that original exodus. Now, in the meantime, in the rest of Arabia, especially in the land of Hijaz, the children of Ibrahim alayhi salam, through the lineage of which messenger? Ismail alayhi salam, they're settling in different places. They're not all in Mecca. He made dua for them in Mecca, this is true. But they were dispersed all over Arabia. They were not in one place. And about 100, this is around the same time that this collapse took place, there's a historical figure we learn about in the books of history. Ibn Khaldun mentions him in detail. His name is Uthay ibn Kalam, and he was a leader among the Arabs who was from the family of Ismail alayhi salam. And he makes a call to the children of Ismail, the Arabs, to unify and to move to Mecca, to make it a central city from which they can establish some makings of a state. Now the Arab concept of state is not the same as the Roman concept of state or the Persian concept of state or even what we consider state in our terms. But they're saying Arabs are Bedouins, they're dispersed, let's unify our family forces, settle them together in one place and become one block strength and form something like a state. This was the call that he made, and he was a very charismatic leader, so he was able to do this very, very quickly. When he, by the way, is born in the year 400. So he's born about 50 years before that great flood happens in another part of the world, which is in Yemen. Now, he historically is called Al-Mujammi'. That's the title he was given historically. Why? Mujammi' means the one who caused gathering, who made gathering happen, right? He allowed for all the Arabs that were dispersed, the children of Ismail alayhi salam, to commune and to gather where? Which city now? In Mecca. Mecca already had a population, but very small. But now it starts becoming more centralized and starts getting populated. Now, this man, Uthay, has three sons. And one of the most popular of his sons, the most famous of his sons, his name is Abd Munaf. And Abd Munaf, after he dies, he starts taking a role of leadership in Mecca. And Abd Munaf has, again, his son had four of his sons. So now we're talking about the grandsons of the great gatherer, right? And who are his grandsons? Those are Hashim, Muttalib, Abd al-Shams, and Nawfal. These are four sons. Once again, Hashim, Muttalib, Abd al-Shams, and Nawfal. Hashim is born in the year 464. So is that before the flood or after the flood? That's after the flood. Flood was 450, if you remember, right? So he's born after the flood. And, you know, so this is about almost a little over a decade after there's a vacuum, there's an economic vacuum that takes place, right? And Hashim is born. Now, as Hashim grows up, he feels that there is this economic vacuum and the Meccans may be in a position to take advantage of that vacuum and call attention of these other neighboring empires to start making trade agreements with Makkah. And he sees this as an opportunity because there's no competitor. The competitor would have been Yemen, and they're basically collapsed. They don't have that position anymore. And a lot of very powerful traders from Yemen have already left the region because they couldn't survive there anymore economically. So he goes himself to Sham and speaks to the ruler Ghassani, is called, and he sends his brother Abd al-Shams to Habasha, he sends Nawfal to Iraq, and even sent one of his brothers to Yemen. So in other words, every neighboring empire he's going and he's trying to make trade agreements with them. So now they look at Mecca as a port to do trade. The selling point for Mecca is the Arabs generally have respect for Mecca. Idolatrous as they may be, they actually had accepted Mecca as the house built by Allah. Even if they're doing shirk, they still had it in their tradition, their lineage, that this is the house of Allah. So it already, as in the culture of that land, in Hijaz and even further down in the plains, this was already understood as a religious capital. So they said, it's already a religious capital, why don't we try and make it also an economic capital and try to use that strategically to our advantage. Now when these four brothers made these agreements, and these are, the word for agreement, this is important now, the word for agreement is ilaf. And these four brothers who went and made agreements, they're called ashab al-ilaf, the people of those agreements, the trade agreements. Why is that word important? What does it remind you of? Li'ilafi Quraysh. So there's a historical connection between the term used for them and what we're going to be learning in Surah Quraysh. That's where that's going to become important. Another name for them was also Al-Muttajirin, which means the traders. Now Hashim was one of those four brothers. Hashim has a son named Abdul Muttalib, born approximately 457, according to most historians. Abdul Muttalib has a son named Abdullah. Abdullah has Rasulullah sallallahu alayhi wasallam. So now we have this timeline and connected to this Hashim being one of the key figures who was involved in the revival of Mecca as an economic power and bringing it to fruition. Now, in the meantime, now we're going to look at another place. So we looked at some history of Yemen while this is happening. We looked at some history of what's happening in Hijaz itself. Now we're going to look at what's happening in the Christian world, in the Roman world. In the year 300 after Isa alayhi salam, in the Christian calendar, the Roman Empire accepts as an official state religion, Christianity. Christianity becomes the official state religion. But the Roman Empire isn't limited to Rome. They include parts of Western Asia, what we call Turkey nowadays, parts of Egypt. They include underneath them Sudan and even Ethiopia, and those are also Christian regions at this time. And actually a good part of Habasha was Christian, and a part of Yemen was also Christian originally. In a brief era in between, the Yemenis had a rebellion and they became a Jewish empire. And when they became a Jewish empire for a brief period, this is the time when they started oppressing Christians. And since they're very close to Habasha, I told you they're kind of disconnected, the Yemenis are disconnected from the Arabs, but from a map, they're very close to Ethiopia, to Habasha. And Habasha is what religion? They're Christian. And they became briefly Jewish, and when they did, their rulers started offending oppressing the Christians. Some argue that this may even include Ashabul Ukhdud, those among the Christians who are Muwahidun and whatnot. Some argue that that happened in that region of Yemen. But when the Abyssinians see, when the Habashis see, and the Ethiopians even see that the Christians are being oppressed, they move in to Yemen. And they actually invade it. And they set up a king from among the Christian Yemeni community, and Yemen becomes a Christian region once again. Over time, though, very quickly, within Yemen, there's infighting. It's political problems, right? Who are they connected to politically now, Yemen? They're connected to Habasha. But they're not really a colony of Habasha. They're left alone. They brought Christian rule back and left. So Yemenis are ruling themselves. They're autonomous. But what happens is there's a military coup. Abraha used to be a general, and he fights against his own king, takes him over, and becomes the new king. And he keeps ties. He tells, since Habasha would be alarmed, he tells Habasha, no, I'm not against you. I just wanted to have this region under my control, and I didn't think the previous administration was running things light, but I want to keep ties and allegiance with you. It became weaker than before, but the ties remain. Now, this is important, the Christian allegiance that we're going to come back to. Now, Yemen, you know, the rulers, one of the ways they retain their power, and one of the things that makes them build the people's allegiance to them, is they remind people of what a great nation they are and how they need to return back to the greatness. So what is Abraha reminded of? He's reminded of the days when Yemen used to be the center of trade before the flood. But after the flood, who took advantage of the vacuum? The Quraysh did. And all the trade moved through Quraysh. So now Abraha decides he's going to build what's called Al-Qulais. This is a huge shrine which he wanted to make as an alternative. It was a Christian place of worship, but he wanted to make it as an alternative place of center. And it said that he used the most expensive equipment and, you know, building materials and exotic items to build this huge monument and building, really a shrine and temple. But his hope was it would undermine the value of Mecca. It's a much more elaborate and glorious place to come. Now he thought, because it's more interesting, that people will come. But people didn't go to Mecca because they found it in a tourist attraction. What was the attraction in Mecca? It was religious. And you can't change people's religious sentiments overnight. So he gets really upset that he's exhausted all these resources into building this huge thing, and it's not getting any traffic. No trade has changed. So he writes a letter to the king of Habasha. And he says, until the Kaaba is destroyed, we're not going to have any attention in our region, in Yemen. So you need to help us. Now, when he writes this letter, the Arabs get word of it. The Arabs hear about it. And when they hear about it, what do? They're very upset that this conversation is even taking place. So some of the Arabs that were a little crazier than the others, there are several narrations. One of them is they burnt the place down. They went to Yemen and they burnt the Qulais down. They burnt that building down. But another more popular narration is that they went there and they secretly entered it and they basically defecated in it, right? And they violated the place and they left. And this was their statement of, you know, this is what we think of your Kaaba, so to speak, right? And Abraha sees this, and this is insult to injury. He's already thinking about attacking, and now he has all the more reason, and now he can actually think about it in a political science point of view. If they have attacked you, or if they've insulted you, is it easier to rally the troops and gather the people in your favor? So he sees this as an opportunity to rally everybody and go after the Kaaba. But historically, we learned he was already interested in destroying the Kaaba. This is important to note. A lot of times when we study this history, without studying it carefully, we think that his motivations were religious. Right? But we have to understand the world works in strange ways. Maybe he has some religious aspirations in there. But what does it seem when you study the history carefully? What seems to be the case? His aspirations are political and economic. He wants his nation to be the center of trade once again. And he sees Quraysh now as this formidable competitor. Also, he realizes we have a huge army and we're backed by the Ethiopians. Who's backing the Meccans? Nobody. So we could do this without a problem. This would not be an issue, right? So he gathers his troops. Now, there are several narrations about how many. The least number that we have is 12,000. The biggest number in history books is 60,000. So we'll say between 12,000 and 60,000 troops are now summoned, and they're heading out. And with them are between 9 to 13 actually elephants. There's one elephant that was really famous among them. His name is Mahmud. They say he was a colossal elephant, and he was sort of leading the pack. So they make their way out. Now, as they go towards, they make progress, they head towards Taif. When they get to Taif, the Taif people, they don't fight them. They say, we're ready to negotiate with you. Now it's important to note, why would Taif want to negotiate with them? The rest of the Arabs would not want to negotiate with them because they're false gods, they're idols. Where are they stationed? They're in Mecca. And that's important. You know why nobody would attack Quraysh? Because Quraysh is holding all of their idols. If you attack them, they're going to go back home and do what to your idol? They're going to break it. But Taif used to worship the false god Lat. And they kept the idol in Taif. They didn't have the idol in at the Haram, they had it in Taif. So they didn't care if it gets destroyed. It wasn't a big deal to them. So they start making a deal. They cut a deal, they say, we have no beef with you, actually we'll help you. The tribe of Thaqif specifically. They said, we'll help you. They appointed a guy, a navigator, named Abu Righal. And his job was, because the way from Ta'if to Mecca is complicated, I will guide your troops all the way to Mecca without a problem. So they even get a snitch to go from Ta'if to go and destroy Mecca, an Arab who's going to help them kill other Arabs, right? Abu Rigal happened to die on the way. He died on the way, and he was buried on the way. And this became a monument. Arabs would go there and spit and curse and like throw pebbles at his grave and stuff, because he was a historical sellout. And he sold the location of Mecca and directions to Mecca out to the army of Abraha. Anyhow, so he gets there in the month of Muharram, by the way. Abraha gets to the region in the month of Muharram. Now, this backdrop is very important. Why is this backdrop important? Because when we study this surah, and Allah Azza wa Jalla tells us, أَلَمْ تَرَى كَيْفَ, which is our job next week, inshallah ta'ala, is to study the words of the surah. Today, my focus was just history, and why this history is important. This history is important, first of all, to note that the reasons why Mecca was attacked were, there's political sentiments in there, there are economic sentiments in there. This is important to note. Now, if you look at Surah Al-Fil, Allah Azza wa Jalla talks about the political and the military safety of Mecca. And when you look at Quraysh, Allah talks about, Allah talks about the economic security of Mecca. These two different aspects of the security of Mecca are going to be dealt with in these surahs. Now, today, inshallah ta'ala, I'm going to be very brief and just talk about, you know, a sprinkling of aspects of the surah, but really our focus will be, inshallah ta'ala, next week on the word-by-word analysis of the surah. But at least a sprinkling of items today, inshallah ta'ala. Number one is the issue of alam tara. Did you see? Did you not see? Is how it's translated. Did you not see? This is a figure of speech in Arabic. First of all, it's in the singular. In English, that's kind of hard to spot, because if had we said alam taraw or alam tara, the English translation would still say, did you not see? Because for English, the word you is both singular or plural. It doesn't make a difference. But in Arabic, alam tara is when you're talking to one. Alam taraw is when you're talking to a lot. So it makes a difference, right? Now, this is singular. This made a debate among the Mufassirun, whether is this talking to the Messenger sallallahu alaihi wasallam, or is it talking to each and every individual who is being asked to reflect? Now, there are evidences for both. There are evidences for both. For example, وَقَضَى رَبُّكَ أَلَّا تَعْبُدُوا إِلَّا إِيَّاهُ وَبِالْوَالِدِينِ إِحْسَانًا. Your master declared that you should worship none except he, and you should be the best to both parents. Now, that you in that ayah is singular. But the Messenger doesn't have what? He doesn't have both parents. So who's the ayah talking to, even though it's you singular? It's talking to human beings, the rest of us, right? So there's precedence for the you singular in the Qur'an being used for the Messenger and also for other than the Messenger, sallallahu alayhi wasallam. But the singular implies, the rhetorical function of that is, because this is not an ancient event, this is a very recent event. And perhaps a lot of the people who saw this happen in front of them, right? They were eyewitnesses to this. They are being asked to remember it one at a time. Each and every individual in the town can testify to what happened. Alam tara. So that's one way of looking at it. Another is that the Messenger is being asked alam tara, which makes it a little more difficult to interpret. Because if you say to the Messenger, did you not see how your master dealt with the people of the elephant? Well, there's only one problem. He didn't, because he was born when? He was born after. Then you understand alam tara in a figurative sense. In other words, did you not reflect upon? Did you not realize? Have you not heard enough times? Have you not heard full depictions of how Allah protected the city as you were growing up even? In other words, the Quraysh were so amazed at this event. And what happened really is very, very amazing, that you could imagine that they talked about this all the time. And so much so that actually the Arabs didn't have a calendar. Like the Christians have a calendar revolving around what? The alleged death of Christ, right? That's what their calendar revolves around. The Arabs didn't have a calendar. And guess what their calendar became? Aam al-Fil. So and so happened 10 years before Aam al-Fil. Such and so happened 10 years after Aam al-Fil. Their point of reference became this, right? So this is something that was talked about all the time, as though, you know, given the vivid nature of the language, people could even imagine what happened. So that's one way of looking at alam tara. But then there's the word kaifa. And the word kaifa is very important, because it alludes to yufidu ta'jib. How can Allah do that? How did your master deal with them? If you look at the army and the size of it, the size of the army is greater than the population of Mecca. You know, the size of the army is greater than the civilian population, what to speak of the military population. It is such an impossible scenario that this situation would be resolved peacefully without the loss of civilian life. It's impossible in history to imagine an event where such a massive army would come against a town which doesn't even have a population of soldiers to defend themselves. And even if they did, they've never seen an elephant, which is the ancient tank, right? It's the tank of back in the day. And they have, you know, a dozen elephants, which is more than enough to basically destroy the entire town. Keep in mind, they don't have brick architecture. Elephants can literally run the huts over. You could flatten the entire city. In such an impossible scenario, how can it be, if not by the work of the master, of the Lord, that this city's peace would be retained? So the word kaifa in the ayah becomes very important. That you know, didn't you realize how this could happen if not for Allah Azza wa Jalla? Did you not realize this cannot be just some random accident? Did you not realize that someone is taking care of this city, even in face of Ashab al-Fil, the most vicious of armies, the most, you know, well-prepared, well-equipped of armies? So that's really the point at which I'm going to conclude today, inshallah ta'ala, is the reflection and some benefits of just the phrase, alam tara. Inshallah ta'ala, we'll conclude the study of this surah and probably even get into the study of the next surah in our next session, Surah Quraysh, and tie the two together and do a word-by-word analysis, because we don't need a separate historical analysis for Surah Quraysh now, because we understand the scene that is set historically. So we'll deal with the surahs, both of them, inshallah ta'ala, at the same time. Barakallahu li wa lakum fil Qur'an al-Hakim, wa nafa'ni wa iyyakum bil ayati wa dhikr al-Hakim. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullah.